listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Race of His Life by Chris Smith. Yet much of the work of piecing together the strategy and the machinery has occurred in Wilmington, Delaware, outside the national media spotlight, which has contributed to a perception among many Democrats that the Biden campaign is eerily, delusionally calm. What scares me to death is they think they've proven everyone wrong every time, a senior Democratic insider says. They have this outward posture of, we came from nowhere in the 2020 primary. We're the only ones who beat Trump in the general, so trust us. But remember, in the fall of 2020, they sent Biden to Ohio and Kamala Harris to Texas, where they had no chance, when they could have been in Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, and Pennsylvania. So let's not get on too high of a horse. Maybe so, though Biden visited and won those four key states 4 years ago, and up close, it's clear no one is resting on their horses or their laurels. The 2024 campaign's activities are intense and far-reaching, permeated by a deep sense of urgency. I can certainly feel the weight of what we're doing, says Dan Kinnunen, who leads the battleground state effort. But to be in it gives a measure of purpose that is different than just allowing your anxieties to take you somewhere else. Biden's lieutenants have forceful, detailed, logical pushbacks to every possible criticism of the campaign. There's only one part of the re-election operation that feels unnerving. So much of the victory calculus hinges on voters, once they've heard the relevant facts, behaving rationally. That worry is compounded by the stakes. If we lose this election, a national Democratic strategist says, we might not have another one. Rob Flaherty rates a private corner office. One of its walls is decorated with images of Biden's trademark aviator sunglasses in a repeating pattern of green, blue, black, and orange. The opposite wall is dominated by a banner, its black background contrasting with large white letters reading, "Nobody knows anything." Flaherty had better know something. His title, Deputy Campaign Manager, doesn't even hint at the magnitude of his responsibilities. The 32-year-old oversees two crucial aspects of Biden's campaign, digital strategy and relational organizing. The first role means not simply figuring out how to target a multi-million dollar pro-Biden online ad campaign, but trying to fight off a fire hose of right-wing attacks and disinformation. Flaherty did this craftily for Biden during the 2020 campaign, particularly in steering an effort to identify market-moving issues, separating things that had the potential to actually influence voters, like concerns about Biden's mental fitness, from mere noise, like the Republican obsession with Hunter Biden. In some respects, most notably Gaza and inflation, there are new substantive challenges this time. One major concern hasn't changed: Biden's advanced age. The way you combat the age issue, Flaherty says, is one, he gets out there and addresses it. What you see him doing in his paid media right now, and it's by fighting on the issues that people care about. If we address the fact that they want to see him go and fight for them, the issue goes away pretty quick. Yet the online landscape has changed dramatically in 4 years, with media consumers fractured into ever more personalized content silos, many of them hardened against campaign messaging, a shift that seems to benefit Trump. Voters who do not want to hear about politics never have to, Flaherty says. People who are not hearing about politics, they are not trusting of politicians. They're not trusting the media. So it becomes incumbent on the campaign to think about How do we reach those people where they are? You have to diversify the way you do paid media, right? You can't just spend 70% on linear broadcast television and hope you're going to reach folks. One of Flaherty's priorities is reaching tuned-out potential voters. The voters who we think are pretty much the difference markers in this election, the difference makers in this election, these voters, you have to persuade them to participate, he says. This is going to be a backloaded election for when people start to pay attention. They are largely a younger, more diverse set of people who voted for us last time, who lean Democrat. They hate Trump. They are really hard to reach. And there's just more of those this time. A related task is neutralizing the deluge of Republican disinformation. At the close of any campaign, I know my candidate is in trouble if key parts of the electorate are awash in more negative than positive information about my candidate, a top Democratic strategist says. And right now, particularly younger voters of color on social media, they're hearing more negative than positive information about Joe Biden. How do they turn that? Massive spending is part of the answer, but the campaign believes the cash must be spread over a wider array of formats than ever before and in creative ways. So when Biden visited a North Carolina home in March, Flaherty's team enlisted the family's 13-year-old son to post a video on TikTok, generating more than 5 million views across a range of sites, the kind of reach a conventional rally doesn't produce. The White House has bolstered the president's online presence by encouraging the work of independent liberal influencers, including Aaron Rupar and Ron Filipowski, who have driven news cycles by circulating video clips of Trump's stumbles and incendiary comments. Biden's team is also investing heavily in first-person testimonial ads from ordinary Americans. Having elected officials give speeches or be on Sunday talk shows is important, says Roger Lau, who was Elizabeth Warren's campaign manager in 2020 and who now works closely with the Biden effort as deputy executive director of the Democratic National Committee. But finding that nurse in Nevada who can talk about why capping the cost of insulin at $35 a month is important to their families because Filipinos have a much higher rate of type 2 diabetes than other communities, that kind of video, digital, and social content, it just cuts through in a totally different way. Flaherty comes across as ebullient and exhausted, which is understandable, given that he's crafting, organizing plans in real life, at the same time he's trying to counteract the Lara Loomers of the world online. His digital turf overlaps with his more experimental turf, relational organizing. You have to get people to share content through their friends and family, trusted messengers, Flaherty says. This is important because of what I think is the second trend that is different from 20. In 2022, half of the content shared on Instagram was in private. So if you're running a digital strategy that is aimed just at reaching people in their feeds, you're missing where a lot of conversation on the internet is happening. Getting trusted friends to share political content, both digitally and face-to-face, could be extremely valuable. It is also difficult. Last fall, the Biden campaign launched pilot relational organizing programs in Arizona and Wisconsin, battleground states that went for Trump in 2016 and Biden in 2020, and are up for grabs again. The results of a pilot effort in North Milwaukee are one reason for optimism that the campaign can reach middle-class black voters, whom polls have shown drifting to Trump. A veteran Democratic strategist is more skeptical. It makes sense in theory, he says. The problem is, it's all anecdotal. We don't know enough yet to say it works. I mean, you have an entire voting population that gets their news from TikTok, right? Which is why most campaigns now, we just push all the buttons. We pay for more door-to-door canvassing. We pay more for texting. We pay more for phone banks. We pay more for digital. But no one, not Republicans, not Democrats, is confident anymore on what messaging works. There's no Biden campaign signage on the office building exterior, a choice both sensible and depressing during this polarized, potentially violent election season. Inside, conversations are low volume, the vibe all business. The one whimsical touch is conference rooms named for national parks, which is either a healthy reminder or a cruel taunt that there's a world outside of the campaign. Jim Messina, who ran Barack Obama's winning 2012 re-election bid with O'Malley Dillon as a top aide, says the low-key headquarters location at a distance from the political and media din of Washington was a wise move. The hardest thing is the pressure. Every single day, people are asking them about polls that don't have them winning, Messina says. And something I think we did well in Obama land was stay focused and keep our heads down and build the beast. That's exactly what they're doing, and doing really well. As Flaherty was talking web algorithms, an old-school press release was going out from another office, taunting broke Don Trump for trailing the president nearly 4-1 in cash on hand, and for hiding at his country club while Biden crisscrosses the nation. The tone is more barbed, but the theme is one you hear again and again from Biden's top staff. We are constructing the kind of campaign apparatus that will deliver in November while Trump isn't. In March alone, the campaign says, it launched a $30 million six-week paid media campaign, deployed 20,000 volunteers who sent more than 2 million texts and made more than 385,000 calls and opened 100 new offices. We've opened up our Maryvale, Arizona office in the heart of the Latino community, Rodriguez says. In Nevada, we have 4 offices. Trump doesn't even have 1 office open in the state. They'll try to buy some sort of field operation at the very end, Kennan 45 says. That's never very effective, and so I want to press the advantage that we have. On the metrics that matter most right now, says Michael Tyler, Biden's 37-year-old campaign communications director, your ability to raise the resources, to build the infrastructure that's going to help decide the path to 270, this campaign is on its front foot relative to him. All of which is correct. It is also true that Democrats have won the bulk of recent contest, from the 2022 midterms to a March special election for a state House seat in Deep Red, Alabama. There are signs that the campaign's efforts are gaining traction. Between March 1st and May 7th, at least 24 national polls showed Biden beating Trump, and a Bloomberg poll showed an increase in swing state voters saying the economy is on the right track. And as Trump was stuck in a New York courtroom defending himself against charges of hiding payments to Stormy Daniels, Biden was out on the campaign trail. Next photos, the war room. Biden campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon, Deputy Campaign Manager Quentin Foulkes, and Campaign Manager Julie Chavez Rodriguez. The pattern would be more reassuring, though, if Biden were up against someone other than Trump, for whom the normal rules of political gravity never seem to apply. As would another article of faith inside the Biden campaign, that once Democratic and undecided voters hear about all the great stuff the president has done for them in his first term, and they truly understand his superiority compared to Trump, of course they'll come around to Biden's side. Not a lot of people have a full understanding of all that he and the president and the vice president have been able to deliver, Rodriguez says. Reminding people of what he's done, a campaign operative says, and what the contrast will be moving forward, is just a key part of the story that you need to tell to every single demographic, young people in particular. A Democratic strategist who led a high-profile winning 2022 midterm campaign scoffs. I think Biden has totally lost young people, like aggressively, the strategist says. No one I knew under 30 was excited about Biden before October 7th. And now all the people on the left are just gone. Maybe some will come back when the choice between him and Trump is clear. But I've seen enough focus groups in purple states. People are just so unenthusiastic. Yet the younger voter dynamic is highly complicated, and there are indications that Biden's early and continuous outreach may be having an impact. A Harvard poll in April showed the president with a 19-point lead over Trump among likely voters age 30 and under. Other data indicates that dismay over the Israel-Hamas war has had minimal impact. That's the relatively good news. The downsides are that Biden benefited from record youth turnout in 2020, something that is unlikely to be duplicated this November, and that Biden was shedding younger voters even before the war. The president's campaign is banking on the contrast with Trump to fill some of the gap. It also believes that parochial concerns outrank Gaza for most younger voters. People say they have to fall in love or they won't show up. That's actually not true, a second Biden campaign strategist says. They are economic voters, but they're also strategic voters. Perhaps they'll notice that lately Biden has been canceling billions in student debt. Virginia most recently was young voters, Rodriguez says, referencing last fall's Democratic sweep of the state's legislative races. They are showing up. They know what's at stake. Abortion, a huge issue for our young voters. If this is something that can be taken away, what else can be? While Biden's Gaza-fueled problems with younger voters have likely been overstated, the conventional wisdom has been understating the damage the war could cause the president with swing voters, and not because of their allegiances to Israel or Palestine. The conflict itself has driven perceptions that the world remains volatile, though it was still happening at a distance, literally and politically. Now, campus skirmishes have made the mess domestic, and the president's brand is all about delivering calm. Biden has got to be seen as the reasonable guy who gets shit done, where Trump is a madman, a top Democratic strategist says. You can't do that when you've got chaos on the southern border or chaos on campuses. The Biden administration has put together a compelling record in some big-picture ways, including the revival of the economy, the defense of Ukraine, and advances in the battle against climate change. The campaign's challenge is to translate the president's record into gains that voters recognize in their everyday lives. If we're able to frame the president's accomplishments in the face of Republican extremist obstructionism, Tyler says, you actually have a fantastic story to tell. I mean, I'll talk about black folks, for example, right? Since before the pandemic, black wealth is up 60%, the highest rate of small business growth for black-owned businesses in a generation, cutting black child poverty in half through the child tax credit before MAGA Republicans ripped it away, which Joe Biden is going to bring back in a second term to make permanent. There are also large vulnerabilities in Biden's first-term record, the suffocatingly high price of housing and the immigration crisis to pick two. But presidential elections are weird, unique animals that more often turn on personality than on policy, on what Americans are feeling they need in the White House as much as what might objectively be best for the country. Mood is a powerful force in national elections, and the Biden campaign has identified an intriguing and ominous headwind. We don't like to talk about the fact that COVID still has an impact, a senior strategist says. It's easy to kind of be nostalgic for a time before COVID, to remember, oh well, the economy was better, or I felt like prices were better. And you don't hear Trump every day. People are not viscerally feeling how they felt when he was a leader, because he's been silent for lots of reasons. So we have a lot of work to do. Now, it just so happens that Trump says such crazy stuff all the time that we have ample opportunity. Everyone at Biden HQ is well aware of the possible consequences, both for the country and for themselves, of Trump winning and turning the craziness into policy. The people behind him are very well organized, a Biden campaign operative says. It can feel like an abstraction, but actually there are people I know, and myself, who would be targets. 4 years ago, O'Malley Dillon was the new kid in Biden's small inner circle, where relationships are measured in decades. She had worked her way up to the Democratic campaign ranks, from answering phones for a Massachusetts state attorney general candidate to two stints as a field operative with John Edwards' presidential runs. to Battleground States Director for Barack Obama's 2008 win to Deputy Campaign Manager for Obama's 2012 re-election. When Biden's 2020 Democratic primary campaign was flagging, a leadership shakeup elevated Anita Dunn to top strategist, and Dunn brought in O'Malley Dillon as campaign manager. Biden's prospects improved. Without Jen, we are all sitting here in a second Trump administration, says Emma Brown, who ran Arizona for the Biden 2020 campaign and was the strategist for Mark Kelly's victorious Senate run in Arizona. O'Malley Dillon kept working for Biden as White House Deputy Chief of Staff while raising twin daughters and a younger son with her husband, Patrick. Being on campaigns is like everything I've known my whole life. It is what I believe in, she says, her working-class Boston roots shaping the sound of her vowels. So being back here, which I never really imagined I would do again, I just love what I'm doing. The downside is my kids aren't here, so I'm going to head back at 8 o'clock tonight so I can catch my son before he goes to school in the morning, and then I'll be back here on Saturday. The leadership team includes, among others, Rodriguez and two longtime Biden insiders. Dunn, who remains at the White House as senior advisor to the president, and chief strategist Mike Donilon, who has also shifted from the West Wing to Wilmington. Anita's superpower is that she's fearless when it comes to pushing out messages, says Jen Psaki, who was Biden's White House spokesperson before joining MSNBC. Donilon is a part of the president's brain. Jen O'Malley Dillon grew up with a notepad and a pen at a fold-out table in campaigns across the country. She knows what it takes, Psaki adds. The re-election strategy Biden's top advisors drew up last year outsourced a large amount of campaign duties to the Democratic National Committee. O'Malley Dillon had a large hand in choosing the DNC's assignments. Every single day here is about making sure the infrastructure is built so fundraisers, organizers, and candidates have what they need to talk to voters, says Lau, the DNC official. As the campaign took shape, Dunn was in touch with independent groups like American Bridge 21st Century, which is expected to collectively raise and spend hundreds of millions of dollars to back Democrats. There's 8 or 10% of voters available that may go one way or another, says Bradley Bechok, the president of American Bridge. Abortion, freedom, and democracy have been greater than whatever bullshit the GOP wants to throw out there. The in-house Biden campaign plan called for a gradual rollout at the start of 2024 and a ramp-up through the spring and summer. It already has more than 300 full-time staff working in key states, while marshaling money and energy for a major push after Labor Day. The campaign believes that the large block of disenchanted and disengaged voters means the race won't be decided until even later than usual. It also believes that one fundamental task isn't to persuade people to vote for Biden, but to persuade people to vote at all. The president's modest performance skills don't necessarily help that cause. You felt inspired just walking through the door every morning at Obama headquarters, a senior Democratic operative who has worked for both Obama and Biden says. The campaign now, you know your candidate, is not going to light the room on fire. They don't feel like they're winning, but they don't feel like they're losing. The campaign has made adjustments while sticking to its core plan through tragic surprises like the war in Gaza and through a deluge of bad public polls, even as influential Democrats, up to and including Obama, expressed angst that Biden was in trouble and his campaign was not moving fast enough. This guy, Trump, is a monster, and he's fighting for his life, and you got to fight with that same kind of purpose. I told them they can't operate on the timetable of a regular campaign, the Reverend Al Sharpton says, but they are beginning to do what they need to do to energize the base. Black voters, brown voters, young voters. A campaign operative respectfully pushes back, pointing to robust spending in communities of color since fall 2023. Rebecca Piercy, who is the political director for Warren's 2020 Democratic primary campaign, points to below-the-radar but key hires. People like Chelsea Wininger, who isn't a household name, but who will make a difference for Biden in Nevada, she says. They're building the campaign the right way. The campaign had been plenty busy for months before O'Malley Dillon arrived full-time in January, but her presence adrenalized the atmosphere. Colleagues from prior campaigns describe her as both inspiring, people are incredibly loyal to her, a longtime associate says, and intimidating. Jen is a knife fighter, the senior Democratic operative says, and when she emerges from her Wilmington office, Biden staffers sit up straighter at their desk. One overriding Biden campaign belief is that the general public, and especially the voters who are up for grabs, have real lives and won't tune in to the election before Labor Day. A lot of people aren't like us. They're not weird, and they don't want to pay attention to this stuff this early, the senior strategist says. A second fundamental piece of the campaign's framework is that simply attacking Trump, no matter how justified or how emotionally satisfying it might be, won't be electorally effective. There are a lot of layers of who we're trying to talk to, the strategist continues. When we're doing a lot of our work, we're trying to make sure that the narrative is very clear that there is a real threat. I mean, this guy, January 6th, dictator on day one, ingest bleach, but we're not selling hysteria. We can't over-torque this. O'Malley Dillon puts a finer point on the idea. We cannot be a campaign that just trashes Trump and doesn't say anything about who President Biden is. We can't just be one part of the choice. We have to be both parts. 4 years ago, less than 45,000 votes, distributed unevenly across three battleground states, gave the presidency to Biden. His team expects the margins to be thin again. When we're dealing with an election that's going to be won or lost on the margins in these states, that's when field matters, right? Rodriguez says. That's when our historic fundraising matters. That's when having the right leadership within a state that knows the ins and outs of the state and the different pockets of communities and voters we need to pull from matters. It is also where third-party candidates become dangerous. We are not going to sit idly by and let RFK pretend like he is something he is not, the senior strategist says. But we are not going to over-index on a choice we think is a false choice to some extent. That's why the president's campaign and its surrogates are leaning hard on the message that the real choice is between Trump and Biden, and that pulling the lever for Jill Stein, Cornel West, or RFK Jr. won't merely be a wasted protest vote. Trump's support appears to have a ceiling of about 47%. Third-party votes, though, could hold Biden down to around 45%. Biden's campaign thinks this argument gives them an opportunity with Haley's Republican primary voters from Wisconsin to Michigan to North Carolina. I truly believe, O'Malley Dillon says, if you are a moderate, even a moderate Republican woman in suburban Pennsylvania, you're not going to see what's happened with choice and IVF and choose to vote third party with all we have at stake. Democrats scored in the midterms by emphasizing reproductive rights and the economy, and Biden's campaign will return to those themes, plus the preservation of democracy, as the race heats up this fall. But its appeals will necessarily be multivariate, in the words of one operative. Michigan's a good example, Cannon says. We certainly have to talk to voters in Detroit. We have to also persuade folks in rural Michigan to be with us. We have to work on suburban voters and press the advantage we've created over the years under Trump as Republicans have gotten more and more extreme. We have to keep those white, non-college union voters in a good place and drive that. There are some positive signs. Consumer confidence is increasing, and Biden has been narrowing Trump's lead in battleground states. A ceasefire in Gaza by November would be helpful, but no one is counting on it. Other wild cards, from Trump's trials to natural disasters, will play out unpredictably. O'Malley Dillon, down in her Wilmington bunker, is gearing up to deploy the things she can control: money, ground troops, a digital messaging offensive. The stakes, she knows, are enormous. The campaign's goals, though, are coolly realistic. Motivate enough voters to merely like Biden and combine them with enough who fear Trump. I'm steady, she says, and I play the long game. Steadiness beat chaos in 2020. Doing it a second time will be even harder. Haute Couture, the new book, How Directors Dress, turns the lens on the clothes behind the camera, from Spielberg's denim to Cameron's wetsuit and all the crisp tailoring and baseball hats in between. Opening photo, Steven Spielberg in faded denim on the set of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, 1984. And next photo, Uzen Palsy filming Simeon, 1992. Ridley Scott is standing next to a tiger, The big cat is frozen in motion, leaping up its hind legs, broad mitts set to attack. This is the set of Gladiator and Calcara Malta. The year is circa 1999, which you might have surmised from the style of the shades worn by the crew members in the shot's middle ground, framed between Scott, the animatronic spider, the animatronic tiger, and the back of leading man Russell Crowe's head. The tiger had its moment, slain by Crowe's Maximus in a pivotal fight scene. In this photo, though, it's just a dusty stuffed animal in a fake coliseum with a middle-aged director prodding its belly in a mock-neck T-shirt and baseball cap. Scott's outfit here is rigorously basic. The only bit of ornamentation, a metal bracelet on his left wrist. He's dressed to sweat, to get dirty. Film direction is a strange, amorphous occupation. Its precise duties and the qualities required to consistently perform them are tough to pin down. Directors are storytellers, struggling to conduct an orchestra of artisans and technicians, financiers and laborers, to get big ideas out of their own heads and onto screens. Some are puppeteer therapists, coaxing performances out of their actors. Some are choreographers, others special effects experts. In almost all instances, they are called on to be canny problem solvers, navigating a daily litany of complications, shrinking budgets, scripts in perpetual revision, tight timelines, difficult personalities. What exactly a director must do and how they do it depends on the nature of their film, which means that there is no singular uniform a director must wear. Since they have the freedom to dress as they please, what they put on to go to work each morning reflects a combination of practicality and spirit. A director's choice of attire on set might offer information about both their film and their day-to-day sensibilities. It might also tell us something about filmmaking as a profession and style more broadly. Photographs from film sets are their own little time capsules, showcasing habits of dress from their respective eras. Though the archetypal idea of a film director tends toward chin-stroking auteurism, the actual work of direction can be physically demanding. The hours are long, often spanning entire days, pre-dawn to post-dusk. Conditions can be extreme. Weather is a factor. You spend a lot of time on your feet, on your knees, in the muck, bent double, contorted, crawling, sprinting alongside a tracking shot. Comfort or tolerance for discomfort is key. Proper attire helps, like the keffiyeh, biker gloves, and ski goggles Catherine Bigelow wore when shooting The Hurt Locker, 2008, in the Jordanian desert. Her jeans offered protection enough for her to feel comfortable kneeling on dusty train tracks, and her long-sleeve top sheltered her skin from wind-whipped sand. Look at her wrist on the set of Blue Steel, 1990. Notice the three stacked cuffs, heavy jacket atop leather atop a thick knit fabric. Look up toward her neck, the way the collar of the leather is folded over suggests it's biker's gear. It's a strong look, totally cosmopolitan, still current 34 years later, and it kept her warm on a chilly day of shooting. Even in more temperate, controlled environments, the director gets active, digging into scenes with their actors. Imagine John Woo, shirt sleeves rolled up on the set of Bullet in the Head. Though he's one of cinema's most celebrated and influential action filmmakers, known for his intricately choreographed shootouts and set pieces, Wu turns up on set almost exclusively in business casual garb. Button-up shirts, typically white, tucked into chinos or generously cut dress pants. He would look at home behind the counter of a regional bank branch. Wu's might not be the most durable garments, but they're flexible enough. And hey, similar slacks and shirt ensembles worked for many of his gunslinging protagonists, like Chow Yun-fat's hero cop Tequila Yun in Wu's 1992 classic Hard Boiled. There is something appealing about how white-collar workaday both Wu and his characters dress. It makes these pistols akimbo fantasies feel somehow accessible. Little seemed to change in Wu's wardrobe once he made the leap to American cinema. Wu went Hollywood in only the most literal sense. There is clothing one wears to work, and then there is workwear, a term typically used to describe a category of garment and accessory purpose-built for specific types of physically intensive labor. One key storyline in popular fashion through the back half of the last century is the commingling of these two categories. This tendency hasn't slowed in the slightest. Fabrics and cuts initially intended for manual blue-collar labor became commonplace casual garb, some of the most ubiquitous and anonymous garments available to us. Denim is probably the best example of this phenomenon. Modern blue jeans were invented in the late 19th century by tailor Jacob Davis and businessman Levi Strauss, and worn by workers like miners and cowboys for their durability before catching on with civilians. The T-shirt has a storied history as a military garment and was adopted by laborers, too. The entry of jeans and tees into the firmament of global style had as much to do with their material attributes as their seismic semiosis. It's simply a very functional ensemble, whether for labor or for leisure. Directors wear it to work for the same reasons the rest of us do. Next photos, Owen Wilson, co-writer of Rushmore, 1999, and director Wes Anderson in signature too small blazer and trousers. Spike Lee and Adam Driver, Black Klansman, 2018. Ken Russell and Twiggy, The Boyfriend, 1971. Lena Wertmuller demonstrates a swinging shot on the Don't Sting the Mosquito, 1967 set. Paul Thomas Anderson and Heather Graham, Boogie Nights, 1997. David Lynch directs Dean Stockwell and Francesca Annis, Dune, 1984. Here is Steven Spielberg in a full look of faded denim. It appears broken in, well-loved, softened by use. He's on the set of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, 1984, though with that pensive gaze, this shot almost looks lifted from a fashion campaign. The look is fairly typical for Spielberg in the mid-1980s, though it's missing one element crucial to his popular persona, a baseball cap. Next photos, David Lean amid the elements, Ryan's Daughter, 1970. Federico Fellini gets a shave on the sandy set of Juliet of the Spirits, 1965. Ridley Scott and his animatronic tiger on the set of Gladiator, 2000. Amid the 18th century French court fashions of Marie Antoinette, 2006. Sofia Coppola stays crisp in a signature button-down. On the set of A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, 2019, Mariel Heller channels Mr. Rogers alongside star Tom Hanks. Peter Bogdanovich, Mask, 1985. James Cameron dons a wetsuit for Titanic's 1997 iconic wreckage scene. John Ford, The Searchers, 1956, clad in neckerchief and eye patch in Arizona's Monument Valley. Greta Gerwig wears a prom dress to shoot the prom scene in Lady Bird, 2017. Martin Scorsese in straw hat and bolo tie on the set of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, 1974. John Carpenter, Big Trouble in Little China, 1986. John Singleton frames a shot on the set of Shaft, 2000. Catherine Bigelow layers up while shooting Blue Steel, 1990. In the pantheon of directorially coded implements, the baseball cap slots in right next to the canvas folding chair with a name printed on the back. For filmmakers, the appeal of the ball cap is easy to grasp. Directing is a profession that depends on clarity of vision, and a brimmed cap provides shade and shelter in bright or rainy environments. It soaks up sweat, On a chilly day, it offers a bit of warmth. Usain Palsy's second feature, A Dry White Season, 1989, is set in apartheid South Africa and based on a novel by Afrikaner André Brink that was temporarily banned after publication in that country in 1979. It is a complex story of racial injustice, a society in tumultuous transition, and the dire consequences a schoolteacher, played by Donald Sutherland, faces for trying to stand up for a victim of violent abuse. It was a small-budget passion project for Palsy, and a number of its principals worked for far less than their standard wages to make the production possible, like Marlon Brando, who came out of retirement to play a supporting role. On set, Palsy sometimes wore a baseball hat with a device mounted on its brim, a tiny fan that blows inward onto the wearer's face, powered by a small solar panel. On most, this contraption would look ridiculous, but Palsy's aura, an all-white ensemble accented with cherry red and gold, T-shirt sleeves precisely cut to ever so slightly broaden the silhouette of her shoulders, incorporated it with ease. In an interview with the New York Times following A Dry White Season's debut while she was touring the film to festivals and galas, Palsy said, "In the days when I wasn't being taken seriously, I wore long skirts, very conservative. But now I dress any way I want to." Here's Palsy, elegant in the extreme, on the set of Simeon, the 1992 follow-up to A Dry White Season. When your job is directing a film, if it works for you, it's workwear. Most of these images were taken by unit photographers. A presence on film sets for about as long as film sets have existed, their job is to take stills used for documentation and promotion. I'm interested in unit photography because it captures a particular sort of rupture, our world intruding on the world of a film. There in the rift, we find absurd tableaus like Scott and his tiger. Photos like these are often referred to as behind the scenes, which sells them a bit short. They are above, beneath, and between them too. The director is usually the primary interloper, and their tell is typically their street clothes, often at odds with their film's wardrobe. I think these photos appeal to us because they freeze frame the creative act. A new world, half wrought, all potentiality, its impact yet to be felt. We are attracted to action, and the utilitarian clothes worn by directors and their crews can help us to better understand the efforts poured into shaping these fictive worlds. The appeal of the individual outfits comes from a combination of our perceptions about the people wearing them, the context in which they're worn, and what we know now about the films they helped make. These images depict films being made, that is to say, they are photographs of people at work. Adam Ray, from How Directors Dress, On Set, In the Edit, and Down the Red Carpet, by A24 Publishing. Thank you. the Ark of Hope. For two decades, a succession of committed Palestinians, Israelis, and Americans, urban planners, and Middle East power brokers have been envisioning a revitalized West Bank and Gaza. Now the war and its incalculable tragedies have made their efforts all the more urgent. By Marie Brenner. Opening photograph by Frankie Algino, which shows hands poised over maps. Urban planners in Brooklyn work on architectural renderings of Gaza and the West Bank as part of the revived ARC project, a spatial vision for a future Palestine. The night of October 5, 2023, found the engineer Shireen Shella at a dinner she had dreamed about for years. Inside the boardroom at the headquarters of the Bank of Palestine in Ramallah, she took her seat at a long conference table among 30 others, mostly members of the Palestinian business elite. A few seats away sat her design colleague, an Israeli-born architect. Shila and her companions had gathered to discuss a single urgent question: how to revive the Ark. The Ark had been a visionary study conceived in 2005 by the Rand Corporation. The proposal had been among the grandest of ideas and ideals to remake the economy, infrastructure, and transportation system of the West Bank and Gaza. If it had worked, its creators believed, it would have laid the foundation for an economically vibrant and peaceful Palestine. And now this handful of believers were at it again. Rand, the nonprofit think tank, had contracted with those dining that night, a group that with missionary zeal had committed $2 million. Budget line items were being finalized, timetables locked in. The updated plan would be called a spatial vision for a successful Palestinian state, a monumental undertaking that would not only incorporate design, but analyze a labyrinth of fiscal and security issues. Everyone present understood how their enterprise would likely be received by the world. Another plan for Palestine? Wait until your conceptions come up against reality. At 40, the Sheikh Shile, with her red fingernails and glamorous aura, owns one of the largest engineering companies in the West Bank. A doctor's daughter, she is part of the sizable community of Palestinian executives, PhDs, and business owners. Many people in the West do not understand that there is a highly educated professional class here, Shile told me. Among her key associates, tasked with helping to make the vision real again, would be Kobi Ruthenberg, an Israeli-American architect and urban planner who had worked on a design appendix attached to the Geneva Accords, a 2003 framework for a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine. This would be the first time Shile had joined forces on a project with an Israeli. The revival of the Ark, for that matter, would finally enable Ruthenberg, 43, who had grown up an hour away in Jerusalem, to do something he had never done, set foot in Ramallah to work on an all-Palestinian initiative. Zooming in on one of the room's three TV screens was the man behind it all, Sameer Khoury. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.